You're tuned to 93.5 FM KRTS Marfa. I'm Drew Stewart. This is Talk at 10, our morning talk and interview program. And I'm very pleased to be joined in the studio now by William Andy Cloud. He is the executive director of the Center for Big Bend Studies at Sul Ross State University. It's an archaeological research and research organization would be the appropriate way to describe it.
Right.
Archaeology is something we've explored quite a bit here at the station. There's a lot of exciting things going on at the center, and we're glad to have him in to talk. Andy is a native Austinite, received both his BA and MA in archaeology at the University of Texas in Austin, and has been with the Center for Big Bend Studies at Sul Ross for 13 years. Before that, he worked at the Texas Office of the State Archaeologist and came to the center with Robert Maloof, who served as the executive director until the end of August, and Andy took over on September 1st. And he's been kind enough to come by the station and talk with us about some of the things that are going on at the center and in the world of archaeological research here in the Big Bend and Davis Mountains region. Thank you so much, Andy, for coming by.
You bet.
Well, there's so much to talk about. It's such a one thing we've talked about. Or Bob Maloof talked about when he started this thing that's called the Trans-Pecos Archaeology Program. This area, despite its archaeological diversity and a lot of fascinating history, is one of really the most understudied parts of the state of Texas and sort of terra incognita for archaeologically speaking. A lot that wasn't known about this area.
Yes, I guess as archaeology progressed and a lot of projects occurred around the state in relation to reservoirs and things like that, as federal and state mandates both required archaeology. This West Texas area was kind of left out in left field, so to speak, in that regard during that time of flourishment of archaeology in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Because it's often those government projects that's where the money comes from. They're required to do an archaeological survey before they build a reservoir or a new road or what.
Exactly. And archaeology is very expensive. To really get to the nuts and bolts of things and really learn a lot of things, it requires excavation. And excavation is not only time-consuming but expensive. Then we have analysis and the eventual write-up to complete the full complement of research.
Well, the TAP, the Trans-Pecos Archaeology Project or Program?
Program, sorry.
It was a very ambitious project, and the center was able to raise a good chunk of money to undertake that project. But it's a pretty the ambitions of it are vast, and I guess it was originally designed as a 5-year project to fill in some of the holes in our understanding of the prehistory and history of the region. Do you see it extending beyond that 5-year period or?
Well, we're certainly going to try to extend it on. We're just about done with our fourth year of the program. We've got another year of some foundation funding coming in. We're actively trying to continue the program for at least another 5 years, and I hope beyond that period as well.
Well, some of the areas that were specifically targeted in the project, and there's so much information here, we could talk about this for hours, but we'll try to keep it somewhat concise. One area I know that was of great interest, has been of great interest to the center and specifically to Bob Maloof for many years, is the question of Paleo-Indian presence in this region, the most ancient human activity, I guess, dating back to 8,000-10,000 years B.C.?
Well, yeah, it goes back about close to 10,000 B.C. Is when the earliest Paleo-Indians, what people we called Clovis culture, mm-hmm. were in the area. Now, we don't find a whole lot of Clovis manifestations out here. There are a few projectile points, spear points that have been found, but we don't have a Clovis site to date.
These are folks that were hunting mammoth or giant bison or saber-toothed tigers or something?
That's right. In other areas of the state and North America, we do have association of Clovis and mammoth and remains, as well as giant bison, a few of the other megafauna from the late Pleistocene.
But there's still scant evidence. I mean, that was one target of the TAP, was to see if there could be, if we could find some evidence of either those Clovis or, I guess, the somewhat later fulsome Paleo-Indians in this region. And there's some evidence of the at least the fulsome presence, but still scant.
There's a little stronger evidence of Folsom in the area. There was a major Folsom campsite out near Van Horn, on the edge of the Marfa Plain, kind of that area, where over 100 Folsom points had been found through some work back in the 1950s and 1960s. That site was recently revisited by SMU, and they did some research in that regard. John Seebach, who is on our staff, spearheaded some work through SMU at that site a few years ago, about five, six years ago now, something like that. They did not find really good intact deposits, so that site is not going to tell us what we really need to know about that period.
So what would you all like to know about the Paleo-Indian period here in our region?
Well, archaeology nowadays, the focus is trying to learn how the people behaved. You know, getting into their heads, what was driving them, how long they stayed in an area, what kind of stone sources they were using for their stone tools, what they were eating. All kind of little different aspects of daily life is what we would like to know. Now, finding the right site that's going to tell us even bits and pieces of that thing have been very elusive for that period.
Yeah, but for some other periods, you can excavate a site and really learn, get a pretty rich sense of how the people, what they ate, how they lived,
things about the environment that they were living in, all different aspects of what they were going through in their daily lives.
Well, just to maybe run real quickly down the list of the sort of six general areas that the TAP was focused on, there was this Paleo-Indian facet, trying to find evidence or information about the oldest human habitation in the Trans-Pecos, and then adaptations during the period that followed that, a very long period of time, the Archaic period. How long did that period last?
The Archaic goes from about 6,500 BC to about AD 700. So you're talking over 7,000 years. So extremely lengthy period where we saw slow change, progression, adaptation to a changing environment, somewhat changing environment anyway. New techniques of processing some of the plant foods around them is one thing that we have seen through our excavations.
But there's some continuity through that period. All the people were using spear points or atlatls to kill prey rather than a bow and arrow.
That's probably one of the main distinctions with the Archaic and the subsequent periods that where we get the bow and arrow. The earliest evidence in this area for the bow and arrows about AD 700, 700, 800, somewhere in that time frame. Previous to that, they were using an atlatl or spear thrower and hurling a spear with a projectile on the end of a stone projectile that we call a dart point or spear point. Common nomenclature out there in the public, they're calling all of these things arrowheads, and that's kind of a misstatement.
Because the arrowheads are really more recent from the last 1,300 years, whether these other points you would find would have been part of a spear that was thrown rather than shot.
Absolutely. And we really call even what they call arrowheads arrow points.
Another area of research is what's been called the Livermore phase people and their ritual life, and this is in the Davis Mountains. A lot of fascinating rock art there, and evidence of a pretty rich ritual activity there in the Davis Mountains. And that's been a strong interest also of the former director Bob Maloof. That's something he's particularly interested in learning more about. You've also looked at at farmers and nomads, and I guess maybe that some of the farming research or farming societies that lived at La Junta.
Right.
And also exploring in the historical period the evidence of Spanish exploration and missions here in our region, as well as rock art. There's been a lot of activity with rock art in our area.
Absolutely.
Well, I know there's a lot of projects going on. You guys are working on a lot of different ranches and different properties around the region. I guess talk a little bit about what's most exciting you now that you all are involved with.
Well, right now we've got a site we're working on down south of Marfa on Alamito Creek, where we have four or five hearth features where they were doing their cooking, and This particular site dates back to about 7,100 years ago or 5,100 BC. We have two radiocarbon dates from two separate hearths, and the dates were secured from two separate labs. So we're pretty confident, that we have a secure date for that particular site.
So you're taking some burned material out of the hearth and then having it tested, and they can date that material.
That's right, through the radiocarbon analysis.
And these hearths are the evidence of this is something 7,000 BCE, so 9,000 years old. Is that right? Am I getting it right?
No, these are 7,000 years old, about 5,100 BC.
Okay, but these clearly would they're not on the surface. Is that correct, or they are on the
Well, these particular hearths, there was at least one or two that were barely exposed on the surface on a little bench along Alamito Creek.
And this is what would be called the early archaic period.
Right.
And is there a sense of what's your sense of how these people were living, or what was the Big Bend like when they were here?
This particular site has given us some data in that regard. We had some of the charcoal that was dated analyzed, and it came back as mesquite. And so that throws us back at least 3,000 years earlier than we had previously had mesquite identified from an archaeological site.
Wow.
Now, there has been some pack rat midden identification down in Big Bend National Park of mesquite for earlier period, but that is actually further down in the desert. So this is kind of exciting information. We also have some pollen information indicative of cactus and other modern things that we see in the vegetal community, such as cockleburrs, things like that. It's kind of interesting where this is throwing the modern vegetation and climate back a little earlier than we had previously been able to go.
Because there's some thought that maybe things were lusher or wetter. There was a different sort of flora in this region thousands of years ago, and that things had changed as livestock were introduced and that sort of thing. But this implies that some of those things have been here for some time.
I think it actually does. Now, if we go back into the Paleo-Indian period, we definitely get a lusher environment. Some of the trees that we now see only in little isolated reserves up in the higher mountains were down on the flanks of the mountains, and it may be extending out into the plains in some regard. So we did certainly have a lusher environment there. Now, there was a very long, what's known as the long drought or the altothermal that went maybe as early as 6500 B.C., started about that time period, or maybe around 5500 B.C., within a 1,000-year period there. And this long drought went for about 4,000 years.
Wow.
So it was a very, very long and intense drought that affected the southwestern United States into northern Mexico as well. There's still some debate on exactly how affected our area was, and so we're hoping to be able to address some of that with work at this site, perhaps.
So before that drought would have happened, you might have had these large megafauna, as you say, the mammoth or the large bison moving around here, but after that drought, the climate would have changed and those creatures wouldn't have been here anymore.
The climate was really changing a little bit before that, and we lost the megafauna that we typically associate with the Paleo-Indians. Probably 1,000, 1,500 years before that this particular site was occupied.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Andy Cloud. He is the executive director of the Center for Big Bend Studies at Sol Ross State University. Took over in that position just a couple months ago, September 1st of this year, and talking with us now about some of the very varied and exciting research that's been going on at the center and in our region here. I know you all have been involved in a pretty long-term project, a number of projects, perhaps on the O2 Ranch, which is located in both Brewster and Presidio counties. It's a very large ranch south of between Alpine and if you drive south on 118 and you get out of the hills and go through that long sort of flat stretch with Santiago Peak to your left, that a lot of that is the O2 Ranch.
Right.
And what's going on there at the O2 these days?
Well, we did do a kind of a major project there a few years ago and had a publication come out on the a site that we call the Paradise Site. And this is up in the headwaters of Terlingua Creek. That particular site gave us some of the best information that we've been able to secure from the period that we call the Middle Archaic. And the Middle Archaic occurred from about 2500 BC to about 1000 BC. That particular site was dated to about 4000 years ago. So right now we've shifted the concentration to two different rock shelters that we've been working on down on the O2 Ranch. One of them is known as Tranquil Rock Shelter, and the other is Rough Cut Rock Shelter. These both shelters were used during archaic and what we call late prehistoric times or arrow point times, but most of the activity at both shelters occurs during the later period or the arrow point times.
And what kind of activity was going on in these sites?
Well, both sites we have some interesting arrangement of things. We at the Tranquil Rock Shelter we have evidence of maybe a rudimentary shelter of some type within the shelter. And so this is something we have some remains of what we call daub. This is where mud has been plastered over some kind of a framework, a stick framework, and helped to secure, kind of make a little hut. So it looks like we have maybe a little hut with inside a rock shelter.
And is it, I mean, when you think about, and this is, when you think about Native Americans in this region, probably the names that come most readily to mind are the historic tribes like the Comanche and the Apache. And maybe we know something about the agricultural societies that existed at the confluence of the Conchos and the Rio Grande. But do you have any sense that these people that would have been using those shelters, they're not Apache or Comanche? They're something
different. No, they're previous to that. We can only apply these names for individual tribes or anything after the Spanish showed up and started writing in their records what the people called themselves or applied a name to the people or something along those lines. Before that period, we have to give them names. We have to kind of create a little box so that we can create a discussion as archaeologists and between archaeologists.
So it's really hard to tell whether over these thousands of years periods, whether there was a distinct group of people or various groups of people that were coming in and out of the area, or whether these people were pretty much staying in this area or moving through the area. Those are all big questions and maybe difficult to answer.
They are absolutely big questions, and they are very hard to answer. We're dealing with little bits and shreds of evidence and trying to apply the things that we see are similar in one area to, say, the lower Pecos region or the high plains, and we can, you know, propose some possible hypotheses, you know, about movements of peoples and things like that. And in some cases, we have trouble, a lot of trouble. In other cases, we have some bits and shreds of evidence that at least can lead us down a path that we can kind of make some deductions in that regard.
We think about El Paso and that area sort of more closely linked maybe to New Mexico and the Pueblo societies, and then there's this very distinct thing in the lower Pecos River region where the Pecos comes into the Rio Grande and all this really striking and very old, I guess, rock art and peyote tradition of some kind there. Is there something distinct about our region? Do you get a sense of the people that lived here prehistorically?
Well, I guess in a lot of ways we seem to be very distinct. If you look back through prehistory and history, the historic period or proto-historic period, what's going on in this area, the Big Bend, the Eastern Trans-Pecos region, is kind of got bits and shreds from adjacent regions. So it seems like almost like a crossroads, but that we had distinctive people living here and somewhat probably related to the distinctive environment that is here.
Rock art is something that for a layperson is easy to get intrigued by, and it's striking and can be beautiful or mysterious. And I know there's been a lot of rock art research that you all have been doing over the last number of years. Tell us a little bit about that.
We are concentrating on rock art, and that is one of our research domains in the TAP program. So we have been out actively recording rock art. That is both with photography, various means of photography. In some cases, some digital enhancement that is available to researchers nowadays, where you can kind of use Photoshop and one thing or another to try to help bring out some of the things that have faded. So there is some exciting work in that regard. We also have recently employed a researcher out of Austin who does some unique recording. He calls it kite aerial photography. And so in this case, we had a flat bedrock, limestone bedrock exposure on a hill going around a hill, and we had petroglyphs all that had been etched or pecked into the limestone. Huh. And so getting a field, that's a very large site, and there's all hundreds of motifs, individual motifs, and trying to connect all those together, we go in and record those by hand in individual 1 by 1 meter squares, very painstakingly photographing and drawing and measuring and doing scale drawings of all those motifs. But here, this researcher was able to go in there and take 1,500 photographs and wow. stitch them together with some high-priced software that he has. And we're able to kind of see the whole thing on the computer, where you can kind of look at the big picture and then zero in and kind of see the relationship of things very much in a way that we just couldn't do before.
It's done. So this is done from the air. I mean, you think about sometimes did you give you a different sense of what those – was there a pattern or some sense of that this had a
– It's just you can kind of see the whole pattern there together a lot easier than trying to take our individual drawings – and or individual photographs of these 1 by 1 meter squares.
Yeah.
It's really incredible if you can look at this thing on the computer now and you can zoom in and zoom out and kind of see the relationship of one motif to another.
Is there a sense, and we're bouncing all over the place, but is there a sense that that rock art, are there certain places where you're likely to find it, or is there, I mean, this is a question of what it's for or what the purpose is very a difficult question, but are there typically locations where you would find as high points near water, it's scenic locations?
Well, we get the rock shelters. Certainly, you know, we need rock art by the very name needs to be on rock, you know,
right.
And so we have to have outcrops of stone. Many cases, it's little protected outcrops, you know, where the paint would not, if paint was used. Now, we use rock art to say both what we call pictographs, and that's where there's actually painting involved, creating of a paint, and then applying the paint to the rock.
Right.
And then we have petroglyphs where, what I was talking about before, where they've actually been pecked or chipped into rock. Mm. So we get different kinds of rock art. We also get what we call portable rock art, where maybe stones that could be carried around from one place to another. The Lower Pecos is well known to have these little painted pebbles, what's known as painted pebbles. We have actually seen some etched pebbles down at La Junta that kind of go into this realm. We've also had some painted pebbles recovered from the Big Bend, not as many as what have been reported from the Lower Pecos area, but we have actually collected some of these ourselves through several different projects.
What would be painted on a pebble?
Well, they're for the most part they're kind of abstract designs, and so trying to get into the head of the maker, it's kind of hard to say what they're trying to say. Probably has some kind of ritualism involved. In at least one case, a rock shelter, a cave up in the Davis Mountains, one of these items was secured from up there, and it was in a little nested area of grass and probably had some kind of a ritual meaning. But another one we found down at a site along Lower Terlingua Creek, and this was on an open site, one of the few that I know of that have been recovered from an open site. We got an associated late archaic date, I believe, back about AD 300 or something along those lines.
Okay.
At that particular site,
you mentioned this Davis Mountains research, and there's a very impressive and dramatic rock art site there, the Tall Rock Shelter site.
Tall Rock Shelter, right?
Which is describe that for us. It's very very high.
That is a most impressive panel, about 17 feet high. You can see it from across the canyon. Very vibrant colors, too. It almost looks like it was painted last week or something. And as we were recording that particular panel and having to use ladders to painstakingly measure and then do a scale drawing and all those kind of things, I could see right up on the edge that it had been overpainted. So they had painted it at least one time, and then the paint had faded. They'd mixed some new paint up and then repainted it. The binder, whatever binder they used, probably animal fat or blood or something along those lines, seemed to have worked pretty good the last time they used it anyway, because it's very, very vibrant in color.
So whoever painted this, it was important enough over time that they might have come back years later, generations later, and repainted the site.
Probably so. Bob Maloof has done a lot of research at this particular site, excavated a little area below ground surface at the edge of the panel, and found that the panel, the rock art, actually went below the surface there. There had been deposition subsequent to that lower portion. And so this is a lot of vertical colored lines. There's yellow and red. There's some green, kind of an odd rock art color that we don't see very often, unusual anyway. A little bit of green in there, some other colors. But most of it, there's vertical lines. But there are the very tops of these 17-foot panels, there are these kind of circular things that resemble heads, and we think those are anthropomorphic representations or representations of man in some regard. A lot of this rock art kind of has the feel of like it's from the plains, perhaps, or some kind of connection. Bob thinks it's goes with the Livermore phase people that we think came into the area as early as AD 700, 800. And one of the theories is that they came off the plains.
And then sort of set up residence in the Davis Mountains or in and around the
Davis Mountains. That is kind of the focal point for the Livermore phase in and around the Davis Mountains, extending down into northern Chihuahua. But that is the central focus.
This cache, there was a long time ago, I guess, a cache of points that was found on Livermore Peak, that highest point there in the Davis Mountains. Is that associated with the Livermore?
Absolutely, and that's where the whole name came to be applied to the Livermore phase and the Livermore Point, which is a kind of a distinctive little Christmas tree looking point with right angle barbs. Very, very distinctive point. But that cache was found back in 1895 by a couple of cowboys. And apparently there was a cairn up there. The word spread. People disassembled the cairn, came up with close to 2,000 arrow points, I think most of those being what is now called the Livermore points.
So no hunting purpose for caching a bunch of points on the top of the highest mountain in the Davis Mountains.
Almost certainly ritualism associated with this particular find.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Andy Cloud, the executive director of the Center for Big Bend Studies at Sol Ross. And I guess we talked about that tall rock shelter. There are some images of it on the center's website, if you wanted to get a look at it.
I believe so.
Yeah, so that's you can Google Center for Big Bend Studies and see that image. Well, I know you have to get out into the field pretty soon. We could keep talking for a long time. I don't want to detain you over long. But I guess talk a little bit about do you feel like the TAP has Are you and the other folks at the center happy with how this is helping to fill out the picture of the archaeological scene here in the region?
We've been able to make some enormous strides in research in all these six domains that we talked about here a little earlier. Each and every one of them we have made significant progress in through the program so far. But as you go forward, oftentimes we answer certain questions, but we create more questions for each one of these domains. So this is kind of one of these things that I can't hardly ever see TAP ending in some regard, because there's always something else out there that's going to tell us more and more about what we're trying to learn about the behavior of the people.
Yeah. Well, we're running out of time, and I know you need to get out into the field, but I don't want to wrap up without mentioning the conference, which is coming up, the annual conference at the Center for Big Bend Studies, which is a great way to learn more about the things we're talking about and this research all over all these different areas that's going on at the center. Tell us a little bit about that. That's coming up the 7th and 8th of November.
Right. We do have an annual conference. The one coming up this year is our 15th annual conference. It is on November 7th and 8th. It starts Friday afternoon on the 7th and then is all day on the 8th on Saturday. We throw a banquet on Friday night, and our banquet speaker is West Texas author Patrick Deeren, and he's going to be talking about the historical events and things along the Pecos River. It's kind of a focus of his research. We usually fill up our banquet, so if anybody's interested in coming, they should try to get
Act
to
quickly.
Us sooner rather than later.
What's the best way to register for these events?
Trying to get in touch with our office. 432-837-8179 is our main direct number, and that'd be a good way to find us.